Anyway, so it's going to be a shorter share today because what I want to just do at the end, right, because we're not going to do anything new today. We're just going to take a few minutes, think it's really worthwhile at the end of the year because we covered a lot of ground, to reflect and review and just try to extract a few key themes, I think, that we've seen come up again and again over the course of the 24 Prakim of Sefer Shmuel Aleph that we've learned. So a couple of themes, just review a couple, you know, what we've seen about some of the key personalities, and then we'll call it a year, and we'll head off into the summer to come back with Hashem with Perek Chaf Hei next year. And I think the first major theme, I think there are three themes that we're going to focus on. The first is simply, and they're all related, by the way, Hashem's power. And a key question, we've talked about this, but it's good to take a step back. And it's a key question which really divides all of the main personalities we've seen so far in Sefer Shmuel into two groups. Defined by one simple basic question, which already was asked and emphasized by Chana in the very beginning of the book, which is, do they recognize that Hashem is all-powerful or not? As the Gemara in Brachos pointed out, that Chana invented the name for Hashem of Hashem Tzvakos. Nobody in history had called Hashem Yudke Vavke Tzvakos, Hashem the master of legions, emphasizing Hashem's power. No one had done that until Chana, to realize and truly realize that Hashem's power is unlimited, which in theory we all sign on to, but it's extremely difficult to put into practice until we see it illustrated by examples such as, on the one hand, David HaMelech having the courage and the faith to go confront Goliath, even though, rationally speaking, it should have been insane. And then on the other hand, seeing the failure such as Shaul, you know, in Shaul's first battle against the Plishtim, where for all of Shaul's successes, what was he asked to do? He was asked to sit there and wait with an army that began with 3,000 men. It got smaller and smaller. It was at 600 and dwindling, and he's facing a superpower of the Plishtim. And remember, he has to wait for Shmuel to come to bring a carbon. And Shaul manages to hold on and hold on and hold on, and he gets almost all the way there, but ultimately he cracks. Ultimately, he offers the carbon himself, because he's just not able to get to that level of truly internalizing that Hashem is all powerful. And this division, the Sefer comes back to again and again. The beginning of the Sefer, Chana versus Eli and her sons. Shmuel versus Shaul. David and Yehonasan versus Shaul. David versus Goliath. On which side do we fall? On the side of Chana and Yehonasan, who's able to go with one person and attack the Plishtim, because he says, hey, if we have Hashem on our side, that's all that matters. Chana, Yehonasan, Shmuel, and David keep on falling on one side of the ledger. The other side of the ledger, we keep on meeting Eli and his children, Shaul, obviously some of the enemy forces that B'nai Yisrael encounter. It's a key theme which we've kept on coming back to. The second key theme, related to the first, is Sefer Shmuel's perspective on human power, right? And the more one has internalized that Hashem is truly all-powerful, the more prepared one is going to be to properly relate to and even wield human power. And conversely, the less one has internalized the fact that Hashem is the Melech Malchim Lachim, the more problematic the whole world of Malchus is going to be. So we also saw the Navi highlighting again and again the corrupting and corrosive power, potential of power. And we reduced that at the very beginning of the book with Eli and his sons, who are Kohanim, Kohen Gadol, the Kohanim, wielding the power, and it's a disaster, right? The Mishkan was supposed to be a place of inspiration and Kedusha, and instead it was just a place for abuse and oppression. That theme comes up every generation. Even Shmuel HaNavi doesn't escape. Shmuel's sons find the power that they've been given access to as an opportunity to take advantage. We saw the Mefarshim who said that there's no way to read the Psukim literally. We had a contrast between two different, we had Midrashim minimizing two different sets of sins. right? The Navi told us that Eli's sons were engaged in adultery in the Mishkan, and the Navi told us that Shmuel's sons were engaged in bribery. Rashi said about the major, about the pasuk of, and Chazal had minimizations of both. The sons of Eli, it wasn't adultery. They delayed offering the karbanos of the women who came and gave birth. And Shmuel's sons, it wasn't bribery. It was, you know, certain ways of stuff that was lower level than that. Rashi said, though, about Eli's sons, take it literally. Pshuto kimashmo, he says. And the Medrash is X, Y, and Z. Here's the Medrash about the babies, about the women coming with their karbanos. Whereas Rashi did not say pshuto kimashmo about Shmuel's sons. He says, this is a pasuk which cannot be understood literally. But nonetheless, even if so, the Navi clearly wants you to understand that even Shmuel HaNavi's children can be corrupted by access to power. And then that theme continues from Eli and his sons to Shmuel's sons to Shaul, who we're introduced to as the person who's humble and meek and tov. And we've seen, literally, the Navi said he's going to transform, right? Shmuel said to Shaul, you're going to get a lev acher. Power transforms you. That's inevitable. The only question is going to be, will it transform you for good or will it transform you for ill? And in Shaul's case, as we've seen again and again, that original innocent person, what leadership takes, the demand on Shaul that he has to present strength, he has to force and impose a will to unite the country, that demand ends up pretty, not thoroughly, but heavily corrupting Shaul to the point where the man who once upon a time was hiding, Nachba Lakelim, hiding from power, ends up desperately clinging to it, even murdering the Kohanim of Hashem in order to keep his hold on power. And of course, you know, the tragedy is that the one person, you know, so far we've seen the sons of Eli who were corrupt and the sons of Shmuel who were corrupt, and we're going to see the sons of David who are corrupt, and it's the son of Shaul who's not corrupt. Yonah's son is not corrupt, largely probably because he realizes that David should be king, and Yonah's son does not want the power for himself, right? What does Yonah's son have not in common with every other son of a ruler in Sefer Shmuel? Besides the fact that he's not corrupted, they all anticipated leadership. Eli's sons anticipated they were going to become the Kohanim Gadolim, and they're totally corrupt. Shmuel's sons anticipated they were going to become the Shofet, and they're totally corrupt. David's sons anticipate they're going to become the Malach, and they're totally corrupt. Yonah's son is not corrupt, and Yonah's son also realizes he's not going to be king. He realizes that Ribono Shel Olam wants David HaMelech. The corruptive potential of the kingship, there's a reason why Shmuel was so opposed to it, right? Now, what's the antidote? How is Shmuel able to shine where Eli failed? How will David be able to shine where Shaul failed? Because they both realize that they may be the human leaders, but ultimately they're not the ones who are in charge. You know, as Shmuel says to the people when he gives them a king, he says, look, you can have your king, but ultimately it's all going to depend on whether you follow Hashem anyway. So David, it does not totally corrupt him. Because he's not thinking of power as an end to itself. He's not thinking of himself, the most important thing in the world is for me to be king. It's the most important world. If I'm the most important king, then the most important thing in the world can't be that I'm king. That's theme number two, the corruptive power, the corruptive potential of human power. And I think the third major theme we've seen from the very beginning of Sefer Shmuel, and we even got a hint of it last week, was the theme of tshuva. Theme of tshuva, that you can improve, you can fail, but you can respond, you can return. We drove that home at the beginning of the Sefer when we looked at the state that Klal Yisrael were in coming into Sefer Shmuel. We looked at the aftermath of Pesal Micha and when Klal Yisrael essentially abandoned the legacy of Moshe Rabbeinu. And then Pilegesh Begiva, when Bnei Yisrael abandoned the legacy of the Avos and the Imahos. And then the sons of Eli, beginning of Sefer Shmuel, who are, you know, corrupting that one place that was left. We hoped at least we'd have a Mishkan, a place of Kedusha, some glowing ember that we could build out from. Navi clearly showed us right away that say that the Mishkan Shiloh was a failure. The people have failed, and the core of the Mishkan has failed as well. The Kohanim have abandoned the bris of Aaron HaKohen. The people have abandoned the bris of Moshe. They've abandoned the bris of the Yavos. And we saw so much at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Chana and Shmuel were all about restoring that. Chana as the fifth of the Imahos, bringing back the world of Tfilah and Bitachon. And Shmuel, again and again, compared to Moshe and to Aaron in so many different ways, bringing back the loyalty to Kiyum HaMitzvos, bringing Klal Yisrael back. We saw when the Plishtim captured the Aron Kodesh. So remember, we had all those like parallels to Yetzias Mitzrayim, but it's, you know, we say, Iker Chasar Min HaSefer. Hashem redeemed, he redeemed just like Yetzias Mitzrayim, but all he redeemed was the Aron. He didn't redeem the people. Why not? Because this time around, Gula is not going to come free. This time around, Gula is not going to come without tshuva. And sure enough, Shmuel succeeds in leading the people in a major tshuva campaign in the beginning of Parak Zayin. Shaul, who's the leader from Shevet Binyamin, Shevet Binyamin was left in total disgrace at the end of Sefer Shoftim. I mean, physically, they were almost annihilated. But the total disgrace of the legacy of Pilegesh Begiva, where a city of Binyamin behaved like Sodom. And then we saw in Shaul's greatest moment, in Perek Yud Aleph, when Shaul first leads the people against Ammon. So the Navi drove home, this was the antithesis of the legacy of Pilegesh Begiva. We're going to stand up for the isolated and oppressed group out in Yavesh Gilad, who was a major group back from Pilegesh Begiva. Shaul calls the people to mitzvah. Instead of sending out chopped up pieces of the Pilegesh, that horrible scene from Sefer Shoftim, Shaul sends out pieces of animal. Instead of it being a civil war, it's Shaul uniting the people. So we have, again, another moment of redemption, a moment of return and of tshuva and of undoing the legacy that Bnei Yisrael had been left with. And then two personalities whose personalities are really, you know, intertwined with tshuva. Shmuel himself, who we saw was descended from Korach, but in so many ways is the antithesis of Korach. Korach, who was the enemy of Moshe Rabbeinu and who tried to seize power for himself for his own personal benefit, as opposed to Shmuel, who's the continuation of Moshe and Aaron, right, and is totally opposed to the idea of power for power's own sake. So we have, you know, on a national level, we have the potential for tshuva. On a familial level, we can have Shmuel undoing the legacy of his family. And then the personal phenomenon of tshuva. So we've seen David HaMelech already give us, it's going to become a theme, it's increasingly powerful as Sefer Shmuel continues. But already we've seen at least two major hints to David's power of tshuva. Number one, after his indirect responsibility for the massacre of Noavir HaKohanim, David immediately realizes, he takes ownership of what he did, and he comes to Avyasar, the fugitive, and says, I messed up and I'm going to take you under my wing, under my protection. And then we saw last week when David, possibly, depending on how he understood the psukim, but possibly slipped up, and whether he meant to actually harm Shaul or whether it was only that he felt he went too far in cutting off the corner of Shaul's robe. But David feels regret and David takes action. So you have a whole group of family tshuva, national tshuva, individual tshuva. And at the same time, the Navi shows us the other side of the coin. The Navi shows us people who are totally incapable of doing tshuva. Beginning with Eli and his sons. Eli and his sons who sin. And the Navi, they get Nevuah twice, telling them what's going to happen. And the message is supposed to be, do tshuva. And instead, remember, Eli, you know, he acts like he's the descendant of Aaron HaKohen, but in a terrible way. Aaron HaKohen's shining moment in the Torah was the acceptance of the divine decree. The Tzidduk HaDin, when Nadav and Avihu were killed, Vayidom Aaron. Aaron takes the, he doesn't understand it, he accepts it quietly. Eli was also quiet, but Eli was quiet before his sons were killed. He was quiet when given the decree, the response should have been to do tshuva. And the Navi begs him to say, the Navi says, "Im yiskaper avam beis Eli b'zevach u'mincha." You're not going to get kapara from bringing karbanos. And the Gemara, Rebbe and Abaye, both, you know, make the clear inference from the prophecy of you will not get atonement from karbanos, right? And they say, yeah, what are you going to get kapara from? Torah and gemilas chasadim. But they don't do it. They don't do it. Shaul as well. Shaul, this is most tragic with the parak of Amalek, where Shmuel is basically begging him to acknowledge he did wrong, and Shaul cannot do it. The people in Sefer Shmuel who are able to recognize Hashem's infinite power are also able to recognize their own flaws and are also able to recognize Hashem's infinite ability to forgive. And the people in Sefer Shmuel who do not fully appreciate Hashem's infinite power do not appreciate Hashem's ability to forgive. It keeps on falling out in the exact same pattern. The Eli and the Bnei Eli and the Shaul on the one side just can't appreciate what their Ribono Shel Olam is all about. They can't appreciate Tshuva. And the world of Chana and Shmuel and David, who can appreciate their Ribono Shel Olam Melachim Lachim, can also appreciate that they may mess up, but there's always hope to turn. They or the people may always mess up, but there's always hope to turn that around. So I think those are the three major themes we've seen again and again, and they're all intertwined. How we relate with Ribono Shel Olam, how we relate with are a world of human power, right? We're no longer in the clean bubble of the Midbar. We're no longer even in the world of Yeshua or Shoftim. Klal Yisrael accept, they say, we want a human king. And, you know, Shmuel says, okay, you're going to have a human king, but you're asking for a more complicated relationship with Ribono Shel Olam. You're no longer going to have open miracles. I don't think we've seen one open miracle in Sefer Shmuel. We've seen many examples of Hashkacha. We see many examples of Hashem acting through providence. I don't think we've seen one open miracle except for when Shmuel brought the thunder and the rain in his retirement speech, right? Where the idea was you're transitioning to a relationship with Hashem, which is through nature. But even though you're living in the land and the world and you have kings and politics and power, and we've seen all the palace dynamics that Shaul has, nonetheless, you have a malach, but what really matters is the malach malachim lachim. Some can appreciate that, and some cannot. And so then, you know, just to transition from those three themes, just take a few minutes to reflect on the major personalities we've seen and some of the key ideas which have emerged from them. So I think we've really seen five, right? We have Chana, we have Eli and his sons, we have Shmuel Hanavi, Shaul HaMelech, and David. And then those, you know, maybe you can add Yehonasan. I think those are really the five key personalities that the Navi has been focusing on that we've seen: Chana, Eli, Shmuel, Shaul, and David. Chana, we talked about Chana. The key was recognizing Hashem's unlimited power, Hashem Tzavakos. The Navi associated Chana with Rachel in many different ways. And what's interesting is that. Is that, and this is something the Navi also does, we've seen many, many, many parallels that Sefer Shmuel connects to other parts of Tanakh, and then the Navi will take it to a second level. So, you know, the Navi compares Chana to Rachel, and then also compares the daughter-in-law of Eli to Rachel. But it's like, you know, the opposite aspects of Rachel, right? Chana is compared to all of the tefillah and the bitachon that Rachel represents, you know, the first person we actually see in Chumash, the first one we see in Chumash praying for a child is Rachel. Chana exemplifies that. And then Eishes Pinchas, right, kind of the nemesis of Chana, right, because Eli and Chana introduced as opposites. So the nemesis of Chana we see focusing on the darkest part of Rachel's history, her death, the death in childbirth, which was so linked to Rachel. So we're putting Chana and Eli and his whole world in total opposition, and the personality of Rachel is used to that generally. Generally speaking, it's interesting, we've seen, and we're going to continue to see next year, the personalities of Yaakov and Rachel are like dominant personalities that Sefer Shmuel keeps on bringing to mind as we go through the different personalities we see in the Sefer. We've seen Rachel compared to Hannah. We've seen Rachel compared to the daughter-in-law of Eli, Eshes Penchas. And we've seen Rachel compared to Michal, the daughter of Shaul, the wife of David. In the case of Hannah, totally focusing on the positive aspect of Rachel. In the case of Eshes Penchas, totally focusing on the tragic aspect. And in the case of Michal, it was to see the potential that David and Michal could have had. It could have been a Yaakov and a Rachel. And instead, we saw it ends up in a total divergence. Michal actually totally diverges from the path and the trajectory of Rachel, because she goes from the side of David and Shmuel and Hannah to the side of her father, to the side of Shaul. Eli, I think the key theme we saw in Eli was when the Navi described him as always hearing. We saw, I remember he gave the Musar to his children, I hear, right, I'm Shomea, I hear that there's evil, I hear you're doing things which are not good. He was someone who heard but didn't listen, right? He couldn't do and he couldn't see. He was defined by his blindness, and the Navi associated the blindness of Eli, right, literally he's going blind. He goes blind to what his children are doing. The Navi, the Radak pointed this out, the Navi had the pasuk of Ner Elokim Terem Yechbeh. Right before the light in the Mishkan went out, Shmuel gets prophecy. And it's the light going out, which is what the image we have, the lasting image we have of Eli. Someone who has personal integrity, but just has lost touch with the will of Ribbono Shel Olam, has lost touch with what his responsibility is, right? The idea, the Medrash that Chazal have, that Eli is reading the Urim Batumim when he looks at Hannah. He sees the letters, but he sees them wrong. He's misinterpreting. He's looking in the right place. He's looking at the Choshen. He's looking at the Urim Batumim, but he doesn't see. He doesn't see. He's blind. He hears, but he doesn't. But he doesn't do. It's a legacy of failure to take action, a failure of leadership. And then the Navi hands him the opportunity on a silver platter. Do tshuva. As we said, doesn't take action, and he ends right appropriately with him falling backwards off of his chair. Someone who was obsessed with the Mishkan and the Aron Kodesh, but didn't appreciate that what really mattered was the Ribbono Shel Olam behind that. Right? It wasn't just the world of Karbanos; it was so much more. Shmuel, right, the next third of the major personalities. So the truth is, Shmuel was completely contrasted with Eli. If Eli was defined with an inability to see, then when we choose to Shmuel, we were told by Yosef Hashem le'ra'o b'shilo. There's more seeing, right? Hashem was seen more in Shiloh. Shmuel is able to bring the Ribbono Shel Olam back. He's able to bring prophecy back. They lose the physical structure. They lose the Mishkan, which defined Eli's whole world, Eli's whole existence. And yet, ironically, Shmuel's career is seen, right? We lost the building, but we gained the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what Shmuel is all about. Bringing back prophecy. Moshe and Aaron didn't have a mikdash. They didn't have a stone structure. They didn't need one. Shmuel and Abi does not either. And Shmuel's message that he drives home again and again, right? If Eli was, he listened, but it was a passive listening. So Shmuel also, interestingly, the Navi goes back again and again to the idea of listening. But in Shmuel's case, it's one simple push. Shema Bekol Hashem. That's his message to the people in Perek Ches and in Perek Yud Beis when they want a king. And Shmuel just comes back again and again and again, right? In Perek Yud Beis, listening to the voice where Shmuel said, Shamati Bekol Chem, I listened to your voice, I gave you a king. But king doesn't matter. All that ultimately matters is, are you going to listen to Hashem or not? Shamatim Bekolo or not Shamatim Bekolo? And then appropriately, the miracle that he gave them, the signing off miracle, was the Kolot Umatar, the thunder. Hashem has a voice, listen to it or fail. That was Shmuel's core message to the people, bringing back Bris Moshe, Torah Mitzvos, the will of Hashem. Don't listen to what you think. Don't listen to your own voice. Listen to Hashem's voice. And where did that get brought home most sharply in Parak Tesvav, the Parak of Amalek, where the listening and the voice came up again and again and again, right? Shmuel begins by telling him, Shema b'kol divrei Hashem, dramatically. Listen to the voice of the words of Hashem. Shaul fails. Shaul says, I did it. I listened to Hashem. Shmuel says, Lo shemata b'kol Hashem. Meh kol tzon bakar, right? What's this? What's the voice that I hear? He says, you listen to the people. You didn't listen to Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the ultimate question. Will you listen to your own, you know, moral compass, what you think is correct, or you listen to what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants? That's what Shmuel tells the people. That's what Shmuel tells Shaul, subduing your own personal views and realizing there's another power out there, and it's what he wants that matters. The consistent theme of Shmuel. And then Shaul, I think, you know, we talk about Shmuel, the theme was listening to the voice. The theme of Shaul was appearances. It was all about the gap between the external and the internal. We were introduced to that from the very beginning, where we saw Shaul as someone who was physically impressive. He was tall, handsome, he's straight, head and shoulders above the rest, looked like the ultimate leader. But already from the very beginning, Parak Tes, before long, before he became king, the whole story of the donkeys, before he met Shmuel, we realized this is someone who looks like a leader, but he's, you know, being dragged around by his na'ar to find the donkeys. Right now, this gap between appearances and reality comes back again and again. Shmuel tells Shaul, remember, Im katona tabe necha rosh hata l'shiv to Yisrael. You may think of yourself as small, but in reality, you're the king. The gap between what he looks like to others and what he looks like to himself, how he thinks and what's reality. Shaul convincing himself, right? Hashem is with me. Oh, Baruch Eir, he tells the people from Ze'if, blessed are you. Oh, Hashem wants me to get X, Y, and Z. Reality was something else. And then the last point for Shaul is that gap between appearances or hopes and reality. What kills Shaul is that deep down he realizes it. Right? Deep down he realizes he's not a leader. From the get-go, didn't feel like a leader. And he transforms. He becomes a powerhouse personality. The Navi, in a couple of short psukim, showed his kingship was successful. Politically, militarily, tremendously successful. When he came onto the scene, Bnei Yisrael were dominated by the Plishtim. And there are many, many battles. By the end, the people are united. Most of the enemies have been pushed back. And they end with a loss to the Plishtim. But it's a loss far to the north. Major successes Shaul has. So interesting. The Navi gives it three psukim. It's not the message we would have got unless we've been paying careful attention to it. Because even though politically, militarily, his kingship is a success, ultimately, Shaul himself is a disappointment. And that realization that, you know, while telling himself, Hashem is with me, Hashem wants what I want, right? Because, you know, the will of the king is paramount. So what the Ratzon HaMelech is the Ratzon HaBore. But deep down, what nags at him, that Ruach Ra, that realization, and it came to the fore last week when he said, he knows that Hashem isn't with him. He said, he convinces himself, but right, the reality is different. Reality is David's been chosen as king. And that theme of that gap between, you know, what things look like on the outside, what things are on the inside, Shaul's rationalizations, his inability to recognize the truth, inability to do tshuva, it's so frustrating because we see the goodness. That's the gap that just defines Shaul again and again. And then David HaMelech, right? We've only really begun scratching the surface of David. We have so much more to go next year, but the key theme we've seen already beat us over the head is David is just totally associated with the world of Bitachon. From the first minute when he's facing off against Goliath to the crises that he somehow endured, his ability to lift up the people around him. He has 600 men who come to him who are the dregs of society. And as opposed to Shaul, who was dragged down by the people around him, right? He listened to their voice and spared Agag, spared Amalek. David is able to inspire his 600 men who are with him, right? They like can't believe that David wants to leave Shaul alone. And David says, "No, we're not doing this," right? They're nervous because they're on the run. And David tells them, "Hey, we're going to ask the Urim Batumim. Hashem has our back. Hashem is with us." He brings that message home again and again. right? It all stems from his core realization that even though the odds don't look good, he's one young, unarmed man against Goliath. He's one fugitive against Shaul. He's one band against a whole army. But at the end of the day, he feels and he knows that he has Hashem with him, and that gives him the chizuk to both carry himself and inspire those around him. And it was that core bitachon which created the most powerful friendship we know of, maybe in human history, between David and Yehonasan, right? The friendship relationship, which the Mishnah Perkei Avos had highlighted, the Rambam had explained, is the friendship which is forged in common values, the common value that they both share of total bitachon. Yonasan being chased, you know, him and another guy against the whole army, he's ready to do it. That alliance forged in a shared perspective, where Yonasan in 2 weeks in Parakaf Gimel is actually giving David chizuk, right? Is like the two paradigms for the challenge, and the Navi does not hold back how hard it is, right? The fact that Shaul, who's impressive, comes up short, shows how high the bar is. And it's a bar which Yehonasan and David are able to meet, and it's a bar which inspires all of those around them. So those, I think, are some of the key themes we've seen this year, some of the key personalities this year. And Mir Hashem, looking forward very much to after the summer, jumping back into say to Parak Chafhei and going forward, and we'll drill down to David and Malach. Mir Hashem, hopefully, I don't know if we'll do one Zoom version and one in person version, but definitely hoping to be in person next year. And so I wanted to thank everyone here for coming every single week. And
thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you know when it'll resume?